radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
The opinions and views expressed by the host and guest are not necessarily the views and opinions of the Blake Radio Network. Broadcasting to the world.
Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Cyberspace is a place that only a human being locates, where there's so much information to take. Then you enter an entirely new phase. Once you get on the internet, become World Wide Web.
It's a new welcome world to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. I'm your host and facilitator, Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to stay tuned for interesting interviews, news you can use, and programming designed with you in mind. Free your mind, the rest will follow, right here on the Cyberspace Sanctuary, on the Blake Radio Network, Rainbow Soul.
Cyberspace is the place. Cyberspace is a place.
You're listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network's Rainbow Soul. My name is Junius Ricardo Stanton. I'm your host and facilitator. We thank you for logging on. We thank you for carrying us with you on your personal mobile devices, as well as listening on your desktop. We started off the program with a message in the music from the motion picture Princess and the Frog, Dig a Little Deeper, and that was the admonition of the character Mama Odie. She was the voodoo priestess in the film. It was an animated film, urging the two characters to dig a little deeper, to find their true essence, to try to find their strength, and to help resolve their problems. And that's an apropos message for all of us. We have a great show for you today. We have our guest is Ludna Muhammad. She's a designer, fashion designer, clothing accessories. She has her own line, Ludna's Originals, but she's also designed for other companies. And she's going to talk about the business and her personal history and her take on the business, what I call mobile retailing, from a creative and artistic and crafts perspective. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back following these messages. You're logged on to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind. We'd like to welcome everybody checking in from Real Media Player, from Windows Media Player, from iTunes. We want to encourage everyone to log into our website, which is blakeradio.com, and become familiar with how you can access our broadcast directly from our website. And vice versa, those of you who check in directly from the Blake Radio Network, become familiar with how you can also access us through Real Media Player, through Windows Media Player, and iTunes by logging into their radio tuner guides and doing a search for us in the talk radio genre. You're listening to Rainbow Soul, talk radio at its best.
Hi, I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, inviting you to join me in financially supporting the Blake Radio Network on a regular basis. We need your continuing patronage to help the Blake Radio Network remain alive and thriving both now and well into the future. There are several easy ways you can send your contribution. To use PayPal, click on the help link on the Blake Radio Network's website at www.blakeradio.com, or you can go directly to the PayPal website and click the send money link. Type in rainbowsoul@blakeradio.com as the email address and Unlimited Ventures as the payee. Then follow the instructions. To send a check or money order, make it out to Unlimited Ventures, care of Neil Blake, and mail it to 73 Ireland Place, that's Ireland Place, Suite 109, Amityville, Amityville, New York, 11701. It's easy, painless, and uncomplicated. And you'll feel great after doing it, knowing you're keeping the Blake Radio Network alive and on the cutting edge of media technology. I'm Junius Ricardo Stanton, thanking you in advance for your support.
Peace and love, Black family. You are listening to the Prince of Pan-Africanism, Dr. Umar Johnson, the Black community's number one school psychologist and child advocate. You are listening to Junius Ricardo Stanton here at the Cyberspace Sanctuary on BlakeRadio.com. So make sure you listen to the Cyberspace Sanctuary every time our brother Junius Ricardo Stanton is on BlakeRadio.com.
Our guest is Ludna Muhammad. She's a clothing designer. She's an artisan. She also does accessories. She's an entrepreneur. She's owned and operated her own business for over 30 years. And it's a pleasure to have her on the program. Welcome, sister. How are you?
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm wonderful this morning.
Good, good, good. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, as I stated before, I've been designing for over 30 years. It started out as, I guess, a vision of mine since I was very young. And so I'm formerly of New York. I now reside in New Jersey. But growing up in New York, I was very inspired to learn more about fashion. So I attended the High School of Fashion Industries in Midtown New York, in which I got a very good and extensive education of fashion, design, and interior decorating, which I include in my styling, and they inspired my styling for my line of Lubna Originals. So with that and the need to, I'm a Muslim, I should say that. I'm a Muslim, and so there was a need early on to have modest apparel for women. And so myself and some other women, we got together and we started putting on fashion shows. And so it expanded over to different states, you know, us doing these shows and the concept of modesty in motion in fashion, because this was not something that was being offered in the stores.
Mm-hmm.
So whether one could be able to make it for themselves or find somewhere to buy it, it was a difficult task. So that was my opportunity to fill that niche.
Were you a member of the Nation of Islam?
I was not with the Nation of Islam, even though my clothes also were suitable for the women of the Nation of Islam.
Okay, so yeah. What was your niche market? Given you weren't a member, so you didn't have that automatic connectivity.
But
that.
By doing the fashion shows.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
By doing the fashion shows, I think women connect differently and bond differently than men do. I have to first say that. So a lot of the barriers of belonging to a specific organization, if women hear about something that's going to enhance or beautify themselves or lift them spiritually, they tend to gravitate to it. So we would do these shows in Harlem at the Harlem State Office Building. Like back in, I think our first show was like 1978, and we would do it around the time of Mother's Day. So we found in our audience that we attracted, it wasn't just Muslim women, it was women of all different spiritual beliefs and backgrounds. They were Christian, they were Muslims, there was a Buddhist, because they were family members
mm-hmm.
of the women in the organization. And so, therefore, sisters from the Nation of Islam did come to it. So it began to expand in that way, you know, and from doing that, I was then invited to do shows for other organizations like the International Black Women's Congress, Negro Business and Professional Women's
mm-hmm,
League.
Mm-hmm.
So, as I say, a UNIA, which was a Marcus Garvey movement. So when I say it expanded, it took me into areas that I might not have been initially directly connected to, but the connections began, and that took me to other states.
Mm-hmm. So after that, it took on a life of its own.
Of its own, yes. Yeah.
Now, when you say the organization, was this a designer's organization? Was it a merchandising organization? What was the genesis of that?
Okay. Initially, this organization was made up of Muslim women, and we wanted to raise funds for education for the schools.
Oh,
for
okay. Right.
Islamic
okay.
schools.
Right. Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm. So that's how it sort of initially started.
Well, how did you transit from that to, I'm assuming you're doing this full-time, so
mm-hmm.
how did you transition from that to full-time designing, marketing what you did, not only in the local shows, but then branching out to the point where you design clothing for other people, and in addition to that, you still go around doing the shows and selling your own wares. So how did all that come about?
How did all that happen? Well, that's a good question. But I should say that early on, when I did live in Brooklyn, I belonged to a mosque called Ansarullah Community, and within that community, I had the education in terms of having gone to school and getting that knowledge to for construction.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm probably at, you know, like the ripe age of about 18, I was running construction, making clothing for everyone who belonged to that particular organization. So I was set up with a sewing room, with the crew and staff, and just, you know, making it happen, you know, putting in the hours and the time. And
now,
we really
were you doing
didn't
that? Were you doing that? You had pre-orders, or you were doing it just to build up inventory for resale?
We were doing that to actually clothe the people.
All right, but did you have pre-orders for the clothing? They came and they were custom?
Yes,
custom
we had pre-orders,
measurement,
yes.
Or were you just cranking stuff out and then having an available inventory that people could purchase?
That was what it was.
Mm-hmm.
We would, some of it would come from, as people heard about the fact that we had the factory, they would come and place orders. And then the rest of the inventory was based on the needs of the people that we needed to have for our store, just getting it done,
mm-hmm.
making
mm-hmm.
it happen.
Mm-hmm. So you actually had a retail outlet? You had a store?
Yes, it was a retail outlet
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in Brooklyn.
Okay. So then...
I didn't own the retail outlet.
Right.
It belonged to the community at large, you know.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So having had that success and having a brick-and-mortar establishment to sell your wares there, how did you expand? How did you move on to... Like
okay.
Nationwide.
Like I said, when we started doing in Harlem the fashion shows, and I saw that this was a market in which a lot of women wanted the product, but I could not fill the demand for the product because, as you know, you need a staff for it. So I had to stay at like custom order level.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But, my work was very good. It didn't really fall into the category of, okay, as women say, oh, that looks homemade.
Right, right.
Because
right.
I had the formal training
right, right.
to make it ready for the fashion industry.
And also share, because it wasn't just, you just didn't go to sewing classes. You had to learn about fabrics. You had to learn about colors and
right.
and all of
yes.
the patterns and all of that. So
exactly.
You had an in-depth
background.
Understanding and background.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I had the education in that school, and I give a lot of clout to, and it was high school because I got a future education after that, but that foundation was so strong, and within our school, we had a school store. This is the High School of Fashion Industries on 24th Street in Manhattan. We learned textile design.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We learned about natural fabrics, how synthetics, what are synthetic fabrics, and how to test and tell what's natural and synthetic. We learned about color and how colors, you know, affect mood and
mm-hmm,
all of that.
Right.
We learned pattern construction, what fabric is suitable for what type of garment, then how to take that garment to market. And so that went into merchandising, how to market the product after, you know, after it's constructed
mm-hmm.
or
mm-hmm.
after it's made.
Mm-hmm.
So once you get that foundation, you can take it to just about anything. But I'm saying that was sort of where it started. As I got out and as I said, we did these shows, I started seeing where I could make a very good living from doing custom work, because there was mass marketing. You could find certain things in the stores, but it didn't fit particular needs that
mm-hmm.
women had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I began to do different shows around the country where, you know, if women would visit, say, from like Denver, Colorado, or somewhere, Las Vegas, because this is where all these shows began taking me, to places like a woman would come to a show and say, we love what you're doing. What would it take for us to get you to, say, Denver, right?
Right.
And you know, I'd have requirements of what it would take to get me there, which would be lodging, airfare. And I said, and you have to have at least X amount of people there so that it would be worth my while coming and doing a show.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be what would happen. And when I would get there, somebody else might ask. And so that took me around the country. Other than that, I had classmates who would also say, hey, I went to, say, New Orleans, and we did this overwhelming show for the Jazz Festival. Would you like to come and see what that's like? And so maybe the first year in 1990, I went with a classmate of mine, a former classmate, and we shared the booth, and it was just such an overwhelming response. People from all over the world coming to the Jazz Festival. And it, like I said, you know how economics were back in the 90s, and it was really good. The people were coming so fast that it to buy products that were made by artisans that it was hard to even have time to make the change.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The money was rolling in so fast in terms of the amount of customers, because at a festival like that, you may have 50,000 people coming through there every day.
So what level are you on now?
What level am I on now? Well, as what we call the rag business.
What's that? What's
the rag business is the fashion industry.
Oh, okay. So that's what the insiders call it, the people who are in it call it.
Yes, you okay. Call it the rag business.
Mm-hmm.
As it goes, it has its streams of ups and downs. And right now, it's sort of in, I would say, what is called a downswing in terms of being able to get the types of qualities of fabrics that you need. I generally go to New York because I've had resources that I built over time there, and I see a lot of the stores closing. So what's available to me is not what had been available to me in terms of resources in the last years.
Well, what about globalization? I mean, and that has not impacted you in terms of, like, you dealing with maybe exporters or importers, or you can go directly to the sources in say, Africa, India, the Caribbean for...
Well, I have done that over time. I
mm-hmm.
have traveled throughout Africa getting certain kinds of resources since the early 90s. That... Globally, things shift. And I can say this from, you know, being in New York and having things imported and, you know, for a long time, where you could get just about anything and everything. There are several things that are taking place. In India, I would say the new generation, where a lot of resources did come from in terms of fashion, and having fabrics and all that made. The new generation are no longer the artisans making a lot of textiles, doing a lot of bead work and things like that. Their parents sent them to universities, and they are now doctors and lawyers and
mm-hmm.
all these
other things.
No longer interested in the things that were set up by their parents and grandparents. So the things that we now have coming out are made on a different level, maybe not quite as intricate and a lot more expensive.
Okay. So it hasn't benefited you in terms of, I mean, because a lot of times people think of sweat, quote-unquote sweatshop type arrangements and the cost is lower. So you're saying it's exact now it's the exact opposite.
Mm-hmm. It is the opposite. So to get, and when you go to certain resources you might have for getting, say I make garments from sarongs and unusual textiles that may come from India and Indonesia, they're a lot less of it. And it's a lot of it's not on the same level, the quality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So
what are you doing? So how has that impacted the designer hat that you wear?
Okay, it has a large impact in that a lot of times I'm calling other friends who are in the business saying, hey, where are you getting this now? Hey, where are you getting that? And it's like, well, that's dried up. You know, or I've been looking and I haven't, and I'm due to, you know, do clothing for this season, and I haven't found the gauzes or the cottons or the batiks. These are fabrics that I need to do my line, and I'm behind because I don't have the resource.
Mm-hmm.
And now getting on the planes, you know, taking these trips, which some people do, but it's just a lot less of whatever you can bring back to keep it flowing. So what happens is you have to make adjustments in terms of that and begin to find other kinds of things where you can sell a product. Maybe you don't need as much of it, which also goes back again to custom, doing more shows where you go, when I say show, it could be something you do in someone's home or something you do for an organization or festivals that are in the streets.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to begin to diversify
right.
Maybe one style of which you did business to multiple styles so you can have multiple streams.
Right.
And that's where I'm finding myself at this point.
Now, have you ever had or considered having a brick and mortar retail outlet specifically for your products? Did you ever have that, or that's something that you're not interested
in? I've never had that, and I was speaking to someone this morning about that. I've never had it because my spirit of what I do, I like to journey.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, because I've had friends who've had businesses where it was, you know, in a particular business where they had a boutique or it was in one spot. You have to have people there to run it. You have to worry, you know, you have to, I won't say worry, but you have to consider whether or not these people are going to be trustworthy
mm-hmm.
while you're gone.
Right.
Especially in a smaller business. You know, are they going to come? Are they going to be there? If you've established certain types of relationships, are these people going to be capable of handling your customers or clients or whatever while you're out of town? I found that aspect to be difficult,
mm-hmm.
Which is why, like, if you have in the mainstream stores you go into, there's such a quick turnover of employees
right. Mm-hmm. Right.
For those reasons.
Right.
I've always tried to keep the spirit of my business light so that it doesn't feel like a job you're tied to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When you have the brick and mortar, it can be, as you term it, it can become that because you have to be there or you have to have someone there who is very, you know, reliable or someone's there who are very reliable while you're out of town traveling. I love to travel. It is my spirit to go different places and meet different people. That's a part of what has contributed to my longevity in the business.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it offers adventure. It offers, because when I go to a lot of things, I get information. If I'm going to a conference, say, and it's on, you know, spirituality and different things, and major players are coming with, you know, you get to be a part of it. You get to learn from it. You get to meet people and exchange with them their beliefs, their style, their way of living. Been another perk, life enhancing, life expanding for me. In a way that other people, other friends, other associates that I know who work different types of jobs don't get.
Right. Now, one of the things you were recommended to me by the editor, by Sumaya,
yes.
Helen Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're doing a piece on vending, and I know a lot of entrepreneurs don't like that term.
Mm-hmm.
I'm calling them mobile retailers, or
yes.
what internationally they're called street traders,
mm-hmm.
Because that is an international phenomenon.
Yes.
So looking at that for our people, it offers certain advantages. And
yes,
one of the things that you talked about was mobility, and just doing some research on it. One of the things about it is the adaptability that the brick-and-mortar people don't have. You can go to where there is business or potential business,
mm-hmm.
and you can react because you basically have eyes and ears on the ground. You know what's going on, and so that you can alter your how you do business, or maybe alter your inventory, or see what's hot, what's coming up. That a lot of times the brick and mortar people can't, because they're pretty much, a lot of times they're reactionary to whatever is going on out there, and it may get to them at the second or third level or even later.
Yes, that's true.
So in your mind, what are some advantages to, now you already talked about on a personal level about the growth opportunities, the travel, but from a business perspective, what are some of the advantages of not having a brick and mortar?
Some of the advantages that I found is that I don't have that additional overhead.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I can take that money and put it into additional inventory. Whereas I may use the money, I may use or transfer my money into travel. There's even ways one can even be more creative with that. The style in which you travel, if you've purchased, like I've had a van that took me to many of the shows that I did. So that was an advantage because I wasn't constantly spending money for airfare.
Mm-hmm,
and,
mm-hmm.
You know, even airfare right now is different. Air travel is different than it was, say, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, because we were able to take certain kinds of things on the plane, whereas now we can't.
Right, right.
So other advantages are that when you're traveling around the country, or you're able to meet people who even will expand your business by word of mouth. Now we have, you know, the social media, which also helps to expand business. So when they meet you personally, like when I go out and I can many times see what another person is doing with their business, I can get back to them. I can spread the word about them. Whereas if I'm stuck in a place and I'm not out meeting new potential customers, buyers, whatever, I'm not exposed to that. They have to come across me by either seeing my store or seeing me in some type of social media situation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not still, and I guess I'm old-fashioned in that way, it's not like
face-to-face.
Face-to-face,
mm-hmm.
eye-to-eye, having someone explain their concept and their business to you, or a representative doing it why they do what they do, why they were inspired to do what they do. It's a different type of connection that is made.
Right. Having said that, and you mentioned social media, do you utilize the internet and social media?
I do, and I have. And what I'm working on now, because I've had some sisters who are in the fashion, in fashion marketing, and what they're building for me now is a lookbook. It's called the lookbook.
Okay, what's that?
So it will
be like a virtual lookbook?
Fashion show that you can go online and see the shows that I'm doing, see the garments up close, learn fashion terminology. But we're still right in the process. I guess within the next, I'm going to say 2 to 3 months, it should be finished, because they've been sort of following me around and gathering the information, mm-hmm. gathering mm-hmm. the photos, and compiling it for this lookbook.
Now, do you have a website currently, or you're on Facebook or Tumblr, Twitter, or all the other platforms?
I took down the website that I had to put up, because it was done by people, how should I say, they knew I had a business. They called me and offered to put the site up, and I was paying for it. And after about the fourth year, the prices for this type of site that I had escalated so high that, and it didn't represent me in the way that it should have, that I discontinued use of it. And that's when I was offered, like I said, I had these sisters consult with me, and they was like, no, you don't need this anymore. It's not working for you. Let us do this lookbook. So that's why I have to say unfortunately, because I don't have something for people to reference at this moment.
Mm-hmm.
But upon building this, I am saying I am building this. We will have it up within the next 2 months.
Now, with all the traveling, do you still do custom, and how does that, if so, how does that work?
Okay, with the traveling, I still do custom. I still do for people, when they hear about me, they'll call or email me and say, I have a wedding coming up, or I met someone and you did this for them, or I met someone and they bought something for you and I really liked it, and or through referral, could you do my wedding dress? Could you do my daughter's wedding dress? Could you do a prom gown? I take a limited amount of that kind of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I've also learned how to screen my customers so I don't waste their time and they don't waste my time for custom work. A lot of times, and I say that because a lot of times people will feel, oh, well, that person sews. The old paradigm, when you found out people sewed, meant that I can get it made for nothing.
I can get it made for
close to nothing.
Yeah, but how did that work? I mean, that usually only worked for family members.
For family members, right.
Yeah.
But somehow, a lot of people still have that stuck in their minds, because I just recently dealt with something where I was referred a customer, and she emailed me the dress, the photo of the dress that she wanted, a wedding dress, and she literally said to me, well, my last wedding dress, I paid $100. And I explained to her that if I was to make this dress, it was not going to be like that.
Mm-hmm.
How I asked the question was, what made you want to have your dress made, as opposed to going to a bridal shop and just picking up one of those dresses? And her answer was that someone was going to make her dress, but they couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And, further on in the conversation, it came down to, I thought maybe you could make it for, less than $300. And I'm like, the material that was required just to make this dress cost more than $300.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So sometimes you have to explain.
But you know what? A lot of times the customer, they have an idea, and it's like you hear people say they have champagne taste but beer money.
Yes.
Or they just don't understand.
I remember doing
a piece years ago on a director who was doing a video, and a lot of his clients were the young kids who were trying to augment their rap thing. And he said they really don't understand the things that they want to include, they don't have the money for.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. And that's what I found. So I have to say, too, as an entrepreneur, especially when you're doing custom, you must become adept at screening potential clients.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't just take on everyone and their wishes and their whims and even waste your time with a consultation that they come and, draw out their wish list for an hour and a half, and you're not being compensated
right.
for it.
Or they can't, even with that, they can't afford what you cost.
Right.
You know? So
right.
You pretty much wasted a couple of hours and,
mm-hmm.
and get nothing out of it.
Right.
So
as we were talking, I did want to say this to you as it came to my mind. I come from, my family is entrepreneurs. My father and uncles and all of that had their own business. So and so did their uncles. So not necessarily clothing,
right.
but having been raised in a family where you see, I saw my mother bookkeeping. I saw my father writing out estimates for jobs. He's a contractor. Talking to people on the phone, I'm hearing this. So it's put into your mind how the process goes. And a lot of times I'm adding it because we forget that those things a lot of times is even if we could say is in DNA.
Right, right.
Traveling throughout Africa, you also see how the marketplace is set. And this is something that we've done. You see the production and how it's done and how it's put forth to the people. Being raised in New York, even just observing how a corner store is run, because we had a lot of what we call corner stores,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
how it's run, how you talk to people, how it affects you when someone talks to you a certain way who owns the store. All of that is being downloaded over time. And many times, you know, you don't realize it. So when you speak to someone who is a potential customer or these kinds of things, you remember the things that perhaps rubbed you the wrong way or did not make you feel good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So another part of what I incorporate into what I do is making my customers feel good about their purchase. I don't lie to them about whether something looks good or not, and it's not for them or their body type.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was going to ask you that because you're dealing with people of African descent,
mm-hmm.
and are shaped, and I know a lot of times we want to think we're like everybody else, but we are unique,
mm-hmm.
and our shapes are different. So how has that impacted you? Because obviously if you're doing custom, you're taking personal measurements. And then how has it impacted with the growth of, you know, the rash of obesity in our community?
Well, believe it or not, a lot of the women I design for, we are multi-shapes. We come from different tribes, so we have different body types. I want to say that I never bought into, because I was, you know, I was educated in mainstream fashion in terms of what the European model or the European body type should be, but that is the standard. That is not the standard by which it's not a not the reality standard.
Right, right.
Because if you see women in other countries, there's based on the tribe, and when I say tribe, it could even be European, but based on the tribe that they come from, there's a different body structure and a different body type. And becoming accepting of that, I want to denote a difference between obesity and a round full body type. That's
right,
from
right,
a particular
right,
tribal
right,
structure.
Right, right.
Because sometimes it is confused, and sometimes African American women have been made to feel bad about a tribal structure, a physical structure that is unlike European
right.
structure.
Mm-hmm.
Because what everything that we're bombarded by and see in the media from when we were little girls between our hair and our body types have been not been by our standard.
Right.
We are just
right.
now setting our own standards and acceptance for who we are in our varied body types. Because a lot of times I'll have women come to me and say, okay, I want you to make me this dress, and it's going to be for my wedding or my a graduation or whatever. But by then, I'm going to be a size whatever. And I immediately say to them, you look fine the way you are. I mean, maybe for health reasons, or I don't know what your vision is, but, you know, you're not 20 anymore. You're not 25 anymore. And the body is going to shift, and it is going to change as you mature. Your body does change, even your bone structure
mm-hmm.
and all of that.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So how about, because I also learned that part of why I'm here and doing what I'm doing is to instill beauty, is to bring about beauty. And to help others see their beauty, and not from a standard or a restricted perspective,
right?
But
right.
because I've been around the world and I've seen beauty standards on different levels, it is a perception,
well,
not necessarily
yeah,
reality.
That, right. And the tragedy is, even for the European, they're promoting a bulimic anorexic type. Standard that they know the vast majority of their own people can't adhere to,
right.
which creates this whole psychological thing that they can manipulate to get them to buy stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. And this and the message is always, you're not enough.
Right.
You're
right.
not good
right.
enough. You're not skinny enough. It's never enough. So, you know, we have to decide when we're going to get off that treadmill and know that, yes, we do have a problem of obesity, but what is it from? Is it from you sitting there like a couch potato, not getting out in the morning, getting some exercise, not eating healthy foods?
Or what's purposely and deliberately put in the foods.
Exactly.
That trigger certain things that are bad for us.
There we go.
Right.
So it's about educating along, you know, while you're enhancing and making people feel good about themselves, and I love doing it. So I know it's been my life purpose. I don't know that I could do it having been in one place. I believe I could not.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So what I could say is, when I was freelance designing for a couple companies in Manhattan, and these companies, I would say in the mid 90s, around 94 to around 98, were doing a lot of fashion for African American women, and they did not know how to make the clothing, because a lot of them were Indian or Indonesian. They
right.
did not
mm-hmm.
know how to make the clothing for the African American market, but they had the need to produce these clothing because, you know, we were buying these things.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. They wanted the money. That was their profit margin.
Yeah, they wanted the money. Yeah. So one of the companies that I would buy fabric from, one day he said to me, he said, "Well, Lubna, what do you do with these?" Because they were bedspreads made, but they were made with African patterns and motifs. So I would buy them. I made jackets and coats and skirts and, you know, all kind of accessories with them. And he says one day, I told him, I said, "I make clothing and accessories from it." He said, "Could you do some things for me?" And I said, "Sure." And I designed a line of jackets and vests and coats for him. And he took them to India and he had them reproduced.
Yeah.
He paid me to do the design.
Mm-hmm.
Like some folks that I talked to about it said, "Oh, they rip us off. They took our stuff. I feel like I have been a designer in mainstream fashion, and I wasn't ripped off on the level of I was never compensated for what I did.
Right, right.
And I was also had access to buy even below the wholesale cost they were selling here in America to purchase these things that were produced. What I would do differently this next time would have them say, Lubna for whatever company I'm designing
mm-hmm,
for.
Mm-hmm.
So
you
people
credit,
who are buying the
right.
product would know I was the designer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay? I didn't do that at that time. So when I would have these clothing that would be at another price point other than my main line, people would buy them, but they said, "But we know that this is mass produced. We want what you make from your hand." I would always get that. And that's difficult. That is difficult.
Yeah, because it creates, you know, you still have to deal with, in order to make your money, you still have to deal with the volume. And
right.
So that creates like what you were doing in the very beginning where you had to have your own group of people that were producing for you.
Right.
Do you have a phone number you want to share or email address? Unfortunately,
yes,
we don't have any pictures of your We don't have any.
My email address is Lubna's Closet, Lubnas Closet, Closet at yahoo.com, and a phone number. My business phone number is 856-488-1092.
Okay, give your phone number and your email address again.
My phone number is 856-488-1092, and my email address is lubnascloset@yahoo.com.
Now, is there in existence anywhere pictorial representations of your creativity, what you do, like YouTube or Facebook or anything
there
where
is,
people can see.
The International Black Women's Congress, which is an organization I belong to and have been doing shows for the last 25 years, they have a site that it's called International Black Women's Congress, and some of my fashions and fashions shows are included in that site.
Okay. Where are you going to be? They have a website. Can you give that
they
URL?
They have a website.
Okay, give us that
URL. It's
called
IBWC, which means International Black Women's Congress. And I'll be doing a show there again in September. I'm trying to think offhand. I did a show for the Smithsonian Institute last summer. So some of the photos were archived there. From my show, it was called Culture and Diversity, African American Designers.
Okay. No, I just wanted
that,
so because
yes.
Even though we're listening, it would be better for visual so people could come up there and see the quality of your work and get some idea if they don't, if they're not already familiar with you. What are you, this is mid-June, where are you going to be, say, in the next 90 days?
Okay, we're mid-June now. The next 90 days I will be doing, next weekend, no, the following weekend, I'll be doing the Haddonfield Arts and Crafts Show.
Oh, okay.
That is July, that'll be July 13th, 14th in Haddonfield. That's a very large show with artisans and crafts people. I will be doing, let me find this card. I'll be doing the Philadelphia Sankofa Festival, and that's August 9th from 12 to 6. I will be doing, what else? It's hard to come up with all the different events, but cause I have some custom work in between that.
Right, right.
But those are two large shows that I know.
It's interesting because I live in close proximity to Haddonfield, so my wife goes to that, and we know some of the Hartsfields, they're over there, and they call it.
Last year was my first year doing Haddonfield Arts and Crafts, and I got out and I realized upon walking around, I knew some of the vendors. I didn't know them all, but I knew some of the vendors, but I wanted to break into yet another market. This time when I come back, I'll know better based on the request from the customers that I had how to provide what they need.
What kind of inventory to display.
To carry,
But
so
that's,
I'm
again,
looking forward to that, and we're producing for that right now.
But that's the essence of so-called, what I call them, the mobile retailers. And that's, you have on the ground, and you can respond almost immediately to that, whereas with, say, a brick and mortar, or if you're a factory or whatever, you're dependent on a lot of other things where you're really not getting that kind of feedback.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, we're almost out of time. Give your email address and phone number again, and give some words of wisdom or insight to entrepreneurs who want to get started. And I'm saying that because my approach to this article, at least at this point, is that vending is a micro business. And that's how it's viewed internationally. That's how when you look at the global economy, that's when they look at what's going on around the world, that's how they view it. They're micro enterprises.
Yes.
And so give us some words of wisdom or insights that you've gleaned over your 30-some years doing it.
Okay. I would say first and foremost, you have to be available as a merchant, as an entrepreneur, to show up and be there on time. And I know it sounds a little strange, but many times when you working for yourself, which is, you know, what entrepreneurs do, you can have the tendency for sometimes there to be slacking in that area. You have to be there, and you have to be prepared. You have to be gracious to the people that you're meeting, and many times put yourself, you know, in their places as they're really attending to their needs. And listen, because your people who are attending things and your clients will tell you what their needs are. And you can't have a fixed idea about how it's going to be. You have to be flexible and adaptable in the business.
Right.
You know, and know that you are going to put in a lot of time, but with that time that's put in, you're going to get a lot of benefits from it. And I could say that, you know, I've been in this business, and I've been able to travel the world, buy, you know, buy my homes, you know, do different things, and live on a level that has been very good. But the time and the work has to be put in, and the perseverance, it has to be put in,
right.
And treat others the way you would like to be treated, and or better.
Right. Okay, sister, thank you.
You're welcome.
Hold on a minute. As we close out, give us your phone number one more time.
Okay. 856-488-1092. And my email is lubnascloset, L-U-B-N-A-S, closet, at yahoo.com.
As we close out today's program, this is Junius Ricardo Stanton thanking you for logging on and reminding you, engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow. Till next time, stay strong.
Cyberspace is a place that no army with artillery invades.
You've been listening to the Cyberspace Sanctuary, a safe house for your mind on the Blake Radio Network with Junius Ricardo Stanton. Thank you for logging on. We invite you to tune in again and engage in mental decolonization. Free your mind, the rest will follow.
That no corporation incorporates, no denomination faith dominates, and no court is going to try any.